Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Strang, and welcome to the Strang Report podcast. Today is one of the most important podcasts I've ever done. It's with Ambassador Sam Brownback. You probably know him as the former governor of Kansas, the former United States Senator from Kansas. He is one of the strongest Christians on the national scene. Previously, he ran for president. I've been trying a long time to get a podcast with him, and it was so important that we actually videotaped it and also put it on our Charisma News website, where you may want to check it out. But after the opening, I have my interview with Ambassador at Large, Sam Brownback. He says some very important things. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Strang Report with Steve Strang on the Charisma Podcast Network. This episode was produced to discuss and address issues within our nation and around the world from a Christian worldview.
I'm so honored to be able to interview Ambassador Sam Brownback today. I know him as Governor Brownback and before that, Senator Brownback. So thank you for your service to our nation and especially taking the lead in this area of religious freedom, not only in the United States, but around the world. So welcome to my podcast. And what motivated you to get so involved in the subject and the cause of religious freedom?
Oh, gosh. You know, Steve, I'm really not sure, but I do remember being at a softball game when I was first year in the United States Senate. We were out of session at that time, and it was one of my kids' softball games back in Kansas. And I got a call from a staff member that said, "We did it. This person that was in jail in Central Asia, we got out." And she was a person that was helping in my office and working on religious freedom cases. We had advocated for this person, and he was released. And I was hooked. I thought, wow, if I can use the position I'm in now to get people to freedom that are simply in jail for practicing their faith peacefully, I want to do it. And I really started pushing hard, and my colleagues, and traveling and meeting with leaders around the world on this topic, which culminated years later in me being the ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And then just most recently in this summit for international religious freedom. So it's become one of my major works that I've done in public life.
Well, I first became aware of you, you know, I live down in Florida, when you were running for president. And now looking back, would to God you would have made it. America would be a very different place right now if you'd been elected instead of all the things that have happened since then. But what motivated you to get involved in public life, you know, there in Canada, which I must give a call out to my 92-year-old mother who was born in Kansas. So that has a special place in my heart.
Oh, that's great. You know, I didn't know anybody that was in politics. I was raised on a farm in eastern Kansas, and my community had 250 people in it, so politicians didn't come through. But I met a congressman when I was elected state president of Future Farmers of America. And Joe Skubitz was his name. I represented the old 5th District in Kansas. And I met him there when I was back in Washington for the first time ever. And I thought, this is a great job where you get to work with people. I wonder how you get a job like that. And it really sowed a seed in me of a desire to do public service. And I've been just extraordinarily blessed then to be able to be in a number of different positions. And advocating from my heart, too, of causes that I think are really, truly important, like the one we're talking about here, religious freedom, but also things like life, racial reconciliation, and a number of other issues that I've gotten to work on. It's been a great joy of a journey for me.
You know, in our increasingly secular culture, it seems like the secularists are the ones that are taking the lead and a lot of times setting the tone. But Christians, principled Christians, really ought to be the one that's setting the agenda, especially when it comes for things like the things you mentioned, life, racial reconciliation, and also religious freedom. You know, I'm part of the press, have been my whole career, And the press is really the only one that advocates for freedom of the press. You know, I mean, it's because they're out of business if they don't have freedom of the press. But it seems to me that Christians are kind of nonchalant about religious freedom. You know, it's almost like we take it for granted.
We do in this country a lot, I'm afraid. And I think people are just, look, it's in our Constitution. It's in the First Amendment. We have the Free Exercise Clause. We really originated the concept for government's implementation of it. And we just think it's just part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. But here the Reagan statement comes so true. And that, you know, liberty is only a generation away from being lost. Freedom is only a generation away from being lost at any time. And that could be true even with our religious liberty in this country, as people in the culture now say, well, we don't like your values. And we don't think you should bring your values into the public square, even though we have the Free Exercise Clause that it's in the Constitution that we're granted that authority. I think it's something we've got to become far more aggressive about pursuing. Doing it peacefully, doing it in an encouraging way, but we've got to stand up for these rights, or you're going to quickly start seeing all adoption centers close down if they won't do same-sex adoptions, maybe hospitals shut down if they won't do transgender surgeries, maybe pharmacists not being able to practice if they won't prescribe abortion drugs. You're going to continue to see those threats and pushes in the culture. And it's really for us to stand up and to say, no, if you're a person of sincere faith and you want to peacefully practice your faith, you are entitled under our Constitution and under our laws. And this is good for the country. If you're going to have a pluralistic, diverse society, you have to protect the minority views along with the majority views, as long as these are peacefully practiced. And this is what we built this very diverse nation around, is the protection of everybody's right to peacefully be who they want to be, including if you want to be a committed Christian.
Well, I agree with you entirely. And, you know, they call it cancel culture. Now, they cancel a lot of things that doesn't agree with their agenda, but more and more canceling Christianity. And during this COVID lockdown, where governors were given a lot of say-so, they were shutting down churches under the guise of public health. Yet you could go to a liquor store, an abortion clinic, in some states, marijuana dispensaries. You could go to Sam's or Walmart, but you couldn't go to church. And, you know, thankfully, the courts have reminded these governors that we have the First Amendment, and the very first part of the First Amendment is religious freedom, which I believe is the basis for all of our other freedoms. But things are happening now. You know, you mentioned some of them as possibilities. Actually, some of those things are happening now. And, you know, even a generation ago, those things would have been unthinkable. And I'm concerned about what's going to happen in the future unless we can turn the tide. What do you think it's going to take to change public opinion, to maybe put some of these politicians in their place, which in our system is just to vote them out of office? But I'm not seeing that happen very much.
No, but I think this is going to take a movement of the people at the grassroots level that's like the Right to Life, the pro-life movement. It's going to take grassroots individuals walking and working in their communities to talk to people about the importance of religious freedom and why this is a foundational human right for the dignity of every person, and it's foundational to this country's operation. Without this, this country cannot operate effectively. And I think we've got to back up just the same way really we did in the Right to Life movement, of just starting to talk to people about why life has dignity at every stage. From the very moment of conception to the very end, it has incredible dignity. It's instilled by God with this incredible divine nature to it. And you shouldn't just look past it. You shouldn't say, well, it only becomes that dignified person once it's born. No, it's from the very beginning. It's to the very end. There are difficulties that are with this. And we've done a lot of work, and a number of people at the grassroots level, millions, have deployed themselves to convict the country that life is dignified, that it does matter. It matters at all stages. And now we're starting to win that fight. We're going to have to do the same thing with religious freedom. and say that this is so foundational to human dignity. I believe it was God's, one of his tough choices on human beings to give us religious freedom. He gave you and me the right to pick him or to deny him. And he knew once that he would give us that right, that he'd have to send his son to clean up the mess. And it was going to cost him an enormous amount to do that. And he still does it. He still gives us that freedom. Well, if that freedom is that dignified in God's eyes, and he spent so much to give us that freedom, what should we require of our own governments but that they recognize and give that dignity and that human right and protect it just preciously for the public? I agree with you. I think it's a foundational human rights that you build the other human rights on. And if you denigrate this one, you're going to see a denigration of the freedom of the press. You're going to see a denigration of the freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, because this one's just so foundational and you build on it. And as we've seen this right deteriorate, this is my estimation, as you've seen this religious freedom right deteriorate globally, you see the other human rights contract as well.
Well, so well said. In fact, I was thinking that would be a great sermon. Maybe you should go into the ministry sometime. But, you know, you gave us an example from, you know, getting this person out of jail early in your career. But what are some examples that you found when you were ambassador at large for international religious freedom? I know you traveled the world, you saw a lot of things and made some real strides. Talk to me and my listeners about it.
Well, we made some strides in Central Asia. Uzbekistan is now really transitioning and opening up from a Soviet police state, kind of a leftover Soviet police state. It and Kazakhstan are both opening up. Sudan, which was a militant Islamic regime for 30 years, has now got a transitional government. And one of their hallmarks they're pushing, religious freedom, because they can't operate a diverse society if they demand everybody has to be a Sunni Muslim in a certain order that they agree with. Those things have been successes. We've had successes really on building an international alliance. We've got over 30 countries now that are part of the International Religious Freedom or Belief Alliance. And these are nations bound together to say, we're going to push for religious freedom. We've really got a grassroots movement started of all the faiths. And the key here, Steve, is to get each of the faiths to stand up for each other, to get Muslims to stand up for Christians and Christians for Muslims, that you have the right of religious freedom. And for Hindus and Buddhists and Jewish people and all the other majority and minority faiths, to stand and fight for each other. And that was the summit that we just did 2 weeks ago, the International Religious Freedom Summit, first one ever done, led by civil society. We had all the major religions there. We had people from 60 countries and one mantra, religious freedom for everybody, everywhere, all the time. That's the basis that unites us and people fighting for each other's right to practice their faith peacefully as they see fit.
Well, you know, that's been the case in our country for a long time. It's at least not in the last century or two, has it been one religion trying to put down another. At least in the current generation, it's secularists trying to put down religion in general. And it's almost like secularism is a religion. They certainly have their belief systems. They treat people like heretics. They excommunicate them, so to speak, which is really part of cancel culture. But yet no one on the left would ever see that secularism and radical leftists are really a religion. You know, they're acting like a religion, in my opinion. Do you agree or disagree?
I think they are certainly acting inappropriate. I don't know if I'd put them acting like a religion, but they're acting undemocratic. They're acting against the First Amendment of freedom of speech. I remember years ago, Vietnam War was just tailing off, and Jane Fonda came to speak at the college campus that I was on, and she was a controversial figure towards the end of the Vietnam War. And one person was there saying, you know, I would defend to my dying breath her right to get up there and say what she sees fit, even though he diametrically disagreed with what she was saying at the time. Now, you can look in hindsight and you can say, well, you agree or disagree with her. But that sentiment of her right to say whatever she saw fit was important then, and it's important now. And that was on a college campus then, and it needs to be that way now. And that's a hallmark of an open society, this ability to freely debate controversial ideas and then to, you know, to go off and to say, OK, that's your opinion. Here's mine. And let people listen to it. Let them hear what they think about it. Look at the Lincoln-Douglas debate. You talk about a controversial issue at the time that they're dealing with, you know, the issue of slavery in this country that was going on. And obviously today you're going, that was horrible that somebody would even stand up and defend slavery. But at the time, this was a huge debate. And these gentlemen would debate for hours in front of the whole public this controversial subject so the public could hear and they could decide, do I like this? Do I agree with that? And out of that launched Lincoln's presidential race. He loses the Senate race and wins the presidency off of this debate that he had articulated so well.
Running against Douglas is kind of ironic in a way. And I was in college back in that era too. I remember those days. But fast forward to today, the left and many college campuses don't give the same grace to conservatives. I mean, look at Ben Shapiro and other people that are canceled from even speaking at certain colleges, you know, as part of the whole cancel culture. It's like they're sort of in the ascendancy now, and so they're changing the rules. What must we do? And maybe it's the movement that you referred to earlier. What must we do to shift the discussion in this country?
I think we've got to get back to these first principles, Steve. I think we have to have a discussion with the nation of why it's so important that we have free speech, why it's so important that we have religious freedom. And you may not agree with me, but you have the right to say what's on your mind and peacefully to express it. And I think we're going to have to get back to these basics of this is why this is so important. And this needs to be a debate we have on college campuses in particular. I mean, going there first, saying, let's start debating the First Amendment. Let's start debating free speech. And so that we can get people back. I think we had to do that with the Right to Life movement. If the left at that was saying, you know, this is just a glob of tissue. And then a number of people said, no, this is a human being. It's a very young one, but it's a human, and look, and we now have pictures of it. And that has really moved the debate. I think we're going to have to go back there, and I think it's going to have to be grassroots, and I think it's going to have to be person to person. And we've got to have it, or we're not going to be able to have civil discourse, and we'll be much the poorer as a nation.
Well, I was in college when Roe v. Wade was handed down, I guess you'd say. And I remember the debate back in that era. And I've been pro-life throughout the whole thing. I never changed my mind. Of course, I was raised in a Christian home where life was valued. But it's hard for me to understand why people can't understand that if your mother had chosen to abort you when you were a blob of tissue or whatever they would say, you wouldn't be here. I mean, every single one of us was a helpless, unborn child. But it seems like people are almost blind. You know, they consider pregnancy an imposition. It's inconvenient for a whole group of reasons. I don't understand why people can't understand. It could have been me. And what is it now? 50 or 60 million babies have been aborted since 1973.
I held a Senate hearing one time years ago, a committee hearing, and we were talking about when did life begin. And the left put up several people to testify that, you know, it doesn't begin until child is born or other stages. And I asked one of their witnesses, okay, I understand your testimony, but let me ask you, when did your life begin? And, you know, I hesitated and hemmed and hawed for a while. And but he was a biologist. And he said, well, he began at the moment of conception. But I couldn't think then, and I couldn't reason. I thought, well, at least you said your life began when it began. I think what a healthy thing to have for us to debate and to have that discussion. And if you shut it off, then you can't really, you know, find your path forward as a society. And, you know, the founders, when they created this country, they expected robust debates and a slow moving Congress and lawmaking system to take these things as they move forward and gel forward. And I think that's what we're going to have to do on this one as well.
Well, you've been a leader in so many areas, and one of the areas is racial reconciliation, which of course is being talked about and is a very important subject. And so as we close out this short interview, I'm going to ask you, about the thing that Congress passed back when you were in Congress that's never been enacted, and your opinion about the role of the Christian community in racial reconciliation.
Well, let me start. I think the role of the Christian community is absolute. It needs to be at the front line of this. And if you look at it, the same sin of abortion, which is the spilling of innocent blood, is what we did to Native Americans, the spilling of innocent blood, and African Americans when they were brought here. It's a spilling of innocent blood. And when you spill innocent blood, you know from Scripture, that defiles the land. It defiles the land. And you have to repent and ask for forgiveness for it. So I see these three as intricately tied together, woven together like a three-chord strand. And if you're going to deal with life, you need to deal with what happened initially to Native Americans and to African Americans. So I carried an apology bill one of the last years I was in the Senate. It was enacted into law. It's the law of the land that we have apologized to Native Americans, and no president has spoken it. It has to be publicly spoken by the president to Native leaders, I believe, and to the nation, and acknowledging broken treaties, acknowledging the past issues that we've done, and asking for forgiveness for it, for us to start the healing process, to lance the boil so it doesn't continue to fester. And I think we need to go through a similar process with African Americans, and I think it'll help us, honestly, too, in dealing with racial reconciliation in a profound way for this nation.
Well, you have served our nation so well. I referred to it earlier. I want to say it again. But what is next for Sam Brownback?
I'm not sure. Right now, we just came off this big International Religious Freedom Summit that went fabulous. I'm working on racial reconciliation issues. I'm going to work on a book now on China's war on faith that they have, and then also on this domestic push for religious freedom, because I think we're in peril here, and that'll be bad for us, and it'll be terrible for the world, because if we're the world leader on religious freedom, and we are, if it denigrates here, it will decline around the world, and there will be millions and billions of people that will suffer. So we need to fight the fight here and take care of things at home to project better around the world.
Amen to that. And if people who are watching and listening want to be a part of your movement, if they want to contact you, if they want to find out more information, where can they go to contact you?
They can go on. I've got a Twitter feed out there at sambrownback.org, and they can look at those things and see if they want to be a part, get engaged with some of it, or get our feeds.
Well, thank you. I appreciate so much you taking time from your busy schedule to be in my podcast today, which of course we're also videotaping to put online. And I just wanted to say, God bless you. Thank you for all you've done, and keep in touch and let us know how we can help.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Appreciate all the books you put out too. You've put some very substantive books that have touched the culture, and I really appreciate you doing that.
Well, thank you very much. This is Steve. I'm back in the studio, and I hope you enjoyed my interview with Sam Brownback. As I said at the opening, I believe it's one of the most important. He's certainly one of the most high-profile people I've ever had the opportunity to meet. I also want to remind you about my new book, God and Cancel Culture, which comes out September 7th. You can already pre-order it on Amazon.com. If you go to my website, SteveStrangBooks.com, that's my name, Steve Strang, the word books with an S, all pushed together like it's one word. And there's information. You can get a little code from Amazon that you bought it, and we will send you some free audio books, some digital things, a subscription to Charisma Magazine. The marketing people say that it adds up to $120 worth of value. It's our way to incentivize you to pre-order this very important book. And I'll just tell you that in a few days, I'm being interviewed by the New York Times, believe it or not. You know, it's interesting that they even interested in the book. And after that happens, I'm sure I will share my podcast. But I'll wrap up this podcast with Senator and Governor and now Ambassador at Large, Sam Brownback. So thank you for listening to my podcast today on the Charisma Podcast Network. I'm Stephen Strang. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to The Strang Report with Steve Strang. To read more from Steve, visit his blog, The Strang Report, on charismamag.com. Again, it's The Strang Report on charismamag.com.
This has been a production of the Charisma Podcast Network. Steve and Joyce Strang are the founders and owners of CPN. Dr. Steve Green is the executive producer of the Charisma Podcast Network. We intend to honor God with every podcast and remain thankful to our advertisers and supporters who make these podcasts possible.